And now, ladies and gentlemen, the boarding house is proud to present that master of comedy, a warm welcome, please, for Steve Martin.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
King Tut.
Thought he'd see people stand in line to see the boy king.
To open the show, I always like to do one thing that is impossible. So right now, I'm going to suck this piano into my lungs. Hey, I'm not trying to be a big shot or anything like that, but I get my drinks half price.
Excuse me!
Thank you very much. No, I'm on drugs. I mean, you know what it is. It's the deal, man. I'll have to get small.
I'm so mad at my mother.
Oh, this is an interesting thing. I gave my cat a bath the other day. That's kind of what I'm into. I dig the intellectual kind of thing. And I went to college. I studied the great philosophers, Socrates. I studied Plato. And I finally figured out the secret to ordering food. It's all sound effects. Went into a restaurant, wanted to order milk, eggs, and ham. I'm going to go, mmm. Waiter looked at me and goes, I beg your pardon. You know, a lot of people come to me and they say, Steve, how can you be so venomous? There's a secret to it. There's no big deal. I'll be honest with you. Before I come out, I put a slice of bologna in each one of my shoes.
You people are paranoid.
You are paranoid.
I know what you're saying. You're saying, oh, let's talk about the comedian behind his back. I get it. I see where you're at. No, no. Hey, that doesn't bother me a bit.
Hi, Crime Stoppers!
Sorry, I just lost my mind just for a moment.
But that's okay for me! Because I am a wild and crazy guy!
There's no one place where you can say, that gave me my start or anything. You know, I had 5 different starts or 10 different starts. I started in high school fooling around, and I took my act to little clubs, little folk music clubs in the 60s, and played the banjo and did jokes and did my magic act. And I worked at a place out in Knott's Berry Farm, which was an amusement park, I worked at Disneyland doing magic tricks. And then I went to college and worked at night in clubs. And then I started writing for television, wrote for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour in 68. And, wrote for a couple other shows, and I left TV, went back to live performing, and here I am.
Where does your comedy come from?
I just like to think of something that strikes me funny and build it into little stories and routines, and if it works, it's in. And if it doesn't work, I don't do it. Sometimes in formative years, you leave something in for years that would never get a laugh just because you loved it. I still do that now, but I just make it work. Force it to get a laugh.
Give me an example.
Like Cat Handcuffs, that routine, which is on the new record. When I first did it, you know, I thought it was funny. I thought it was real funny. I didn't think it would go over. And I kept working with it and working with it and finding the way to deliver each line and the sequence of each line. I can remember reading certain lines 10 different ways. Well, he would go down to the bank, cash the checks, disguised as me with a little... He had the little arrow through the head, the kitty arrow through the head, and I had to fool with those words a long time before it really started working.
How many people have cats?
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, 10. Now, let me ask you this. Do you trust them? Because I've got to get a pair of cat handcuffs and I got to get them right away. Just the little ones that go around the little front paws. Or maybe the manacles of four that get all four paws. But what a drag. I found out my cat was embezzling from me. You think you know a cat for 10 years? He pulls something like this. Found out while I was away, he would go out to the mailbox, pick up the checks, take them down to the bank and cash them. Disguised as me. He had the little kitty arrow through the head. And the little kitty bunny ears. And I wouldn't have caught him, but I went outside to his house where he sleeps. And there was about $3,000 worth of cat toys out there. And you can't return them because they have spit all over them. So now I'm stuck with $3,000 worth of cat toys. Oh, sure, they're fun. Got the little rubber mouse, has a bell inside of it. Boy, I hate it when it goes under the sofa. Whoa, give me that, give me that, give me that.
Now, what about your earlier material as opposed to your later material? How do you see the difference there?
Well, the early stuff, I mean, like talking when I was 18 years old, a lot of it I just saw other comedians. I never stole anything from a comedian, actually. I would get it out of old books, old joke books. And I had worked up my own magic act. And some of the stuff was right straight out of the instructions when you buy a magic trick. You know, they got a little patter. So that was sort of my act. And then I made a decision when I got to college just to eliminate everything that had been done before. And I knocked off. It was hard because some of the jokes were great, but they were old jokes. So I knocked them all out and just decided to write everything myself.
What's one of the earlier jokes? Can you remember?
One of my first routines was, my father came up to me and he said, "Listen, stupid." He always called me, "Listen." So when I was your age, I never thought of doing some of the things you kids do today. Darn it. People I really listened to on records over and over and over were Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby, Mike Nichols. On TV, I used to watch Steve Allen. I love Steve Allen. Red Skelton, Jerry Lewis, Laurel and Hardy.
How do you know when an act is, when a part of your act is ready to go and it's funny?
I'll try it out on friends, in the car or something. I say I had an idea, and if they sort of think it's funny or if I'm convinced it'll work, then I'll just go out and do it. Sometimes I'll carry a bit around in my head for a year before I'll put it into the act. I'll have the premise or something, and I'll sort of keep mulling it or think, I got to remember that. And a year later, I'll finally figure out how to use it.
Can you give me an example of that?
Oh, like the routine about, this isn't on the record because it's a visual bit, where I say, "Here's something you don't often see," and then I jump up and down and spread my mouth, with my fingers. It was about a year or 2 years I'd carried around this idea in my head about, "Here's something you don't often see," and then I'll do something like jump up and down and spread my mouth with my fingers. And that was the idea. And then it dawned on me 2 years later that spreading my mouth with my fingers was the joke, and that's when I put it in.
How would you categorize your humor?
I think it's multi-level. I don't think it's zany. I don't think it's cultured or sophisticated. I think it's a mixture of a lot of different elements. Part of it's sophisticated, part of it's stupid, part of it's visual, part of it's just theatrical. It's loose and it's on, it's blue sky. It's like a guy fooling around, like you do when you're a kid with your friends and you're roaming down the street or at school. It's kind of that wide open West Coast tomfoolery.
So let's get going, huh? I think there's nothing better for a person to come out and do the same thing over and over for 2 weeks. And
This is what I enjoy, so I'm just going to do the same thing over and over and over, and I think rather than do it just twice, I think I'm going to do it over and over. I'm going to do the same joke over and over in the same show. This will be like a new thing. Looking for a little different kind of thing tonight, so then this would be good. Okay. Hey, I'm not trying to be a big shot or anything like that, but I get my drinks half price. That's right, for every one you buy, I get two. So I can just have about as much as I want, you know what I mean? And it doesn't affect me. No, I'm not on this stuff. Okay, I have had a lot of fun since I've been here. I do like coming to San Francisco because it's an intellectual town. And that's kind of what I'm into. I dig the intellectual kind of thing. And I had a good time since I've been here. I know that sounds phony because every entertainer in the world comes out, no matter where they are, they go, "Hey, it's really great to be here." And it really sounds fake, but I am sincere when I say, "Hey, it's really great to be here." But I dig the scene here. You know, I'm into the, sophisticated kind of thing, and that's, because I went to college. I studied philosophy and psychology in college, and I'm pretty proud of that. How many people study philosophy in college? So they can never raise their hand, they always go, like halfway, because they're so confused after about 2 years, you know? Oh, bullshit. Anyway, I have a book coming out. I'm pretty proud of that. I'm getting more out of the comedy, more into the series. There's a little child there. Hi. How old is that little child?
Two.
Two? Got a joke for him. These two lesbians are walking down the street.
How do you account for your incredible success? I mean, you are the hottest comedian in North America.
America just came through a very morose period of the war, drugs, very narrow points of view. You know, although the age professed to be very liberal, you know, and everybody do their own thing, if you didn't have long hair and smoke marijuana, you were an outcast in a way, and you were criticized. It's a real uptight society. Right now, everything is very loose, I think. We're more liberal now than we were when everybody said we were liberal. Consequently, what happened is nothing could break through in the late 60s and early 70s that wasn't identified with drugs, rock and roll, certain type of look. And naturally, that's pure fashion. You know, it's the power of fashion. It's like fashion is more powerful than the church, even, you know. I mean, it's like the church fought bikinis, and they couldn't stop it. So I'm just saying that the force of all this peer group pressure was so great that people finally liberated themselves, and they liberated themselves so much that stupidity and inanity, which is the surface meaning of my act, and superficiality and personal orientations, and not orienting yourself to the government and big social problems, and you didn't have to be concerned with the next thing. And that's what my act symbolized, I think, was the personal liberation from the it's anarchistic in a sense, my act. It's oriented, it's existential, it's oriented to the individual. It's socially irresponsible. And I think that's what people see. That's the only way I can explain the mass success.
Excuse me, officer, do you know who Steve Martin is?
Steve Martin is Dean Martin's brother. He has white hair because he won't take vitamin B.
What's he famous for?
He's famous for being such a wild and crazy guy.
Do people know who Steve Martin is?
Yes.
Who is he?
He's hysterical.
Yeah. He's great.
Absolutely.
He's a wild and crazy guy.
I like his balloons.
Wild and crazy.
Crazy. Molly.
Yeah, okay, man. He's
wild and crazy guy.
Oh, here's his sister, and she feels the same way. Steve Martin.
I remembered what he was famous for.
I think he's a rip.
What's a rip?
It's a New York expression for someone who's really just crazy or terrific.
I think he's a rip, too.
Do you know who Steve Martin is?
Of course.
course.
Of course we know him in Australia. Everybody knows his modern, zany approach to contemporary, modern, excessive humor.
He's a chiropractor.
He's very good. I'm jealous.
He plays the banjo really good.
Oh, he's a comedian. Wild and crazy.
What's he famous for? His banjo playing.
I like all his lines. He's just one of my favorites.
Yeah, can you say excuse me the way he says it?
Oh, well, excuse me.
Everybody can say it.
Excuse me.
Excuse me.
Excuse me.
Well, excuse me.
Excuse me.
Excuse me.
Well, excuse me.
Oh God.
Excusez-moi.
I can't think of what he says.
Well, excuse me.
Yeah, I know that one.
Excuse me.
Well, excuse me. Excuse me.
Oh, what a comedian.
He's a wild and crazy guy.
A wild and crazy guy.
You know, I'm really up to here with this. It's just a matter that, you know, I am on stage, and it's my house out here, you know what I mean? And I come out, and I'm giving, and I'm giving, and I'm giving, and I keep giving, and I give some more, and I make a simple request. I say, hey, could I possibly have a blue spot? But I guess the lighting crew feels they know a little bit more about show business than I do. Although I've been in the business a few years, and I think I know what works best. I'm sorry, but I am angry. I come out here, and I can't get a little cooperation from the backstage crew. Excuse me. Sorry, I'm pissed!
I'm sorry.
You can pick out any age, 20s, 30s, in recorded comedy history. 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Only the 60s were humorless in a way, and for good reason. I'm not knocking that and saying everyone was wrong. But every period, comedy was zany. That's what comedy was. In the 60s, it became... my act is superficially stupid. The 60s were superficially intellectual. Whatever the deeper meaning of my act or of an act in the 60s was is... You know, we're not talking about right now. We're talking about just the appearance. It was oriented to language, social comment. I think I'm making social comment, but superficially it looks stupid. So all we've done is there was this period in American history that was, comedy was different. Even Lenny Bruce was zany. If you listen to his records, only late in his career did he become political, and, you know, he said some four-letter words, but they weren't used in a harsh way. They were just, you know, funny when he used them. And if you listen to the records, his bits are just as zany as anything I'm doing or anything that came before, but he was a master, you know, he was a genius.
Steve, what were you doing in the 60s?
Same thing everybody else was. Narrow-minded, long hair.
I met him through my brother John when they were going to high school together. And I got interested in his comedy about 1968.
We're listening to Steve Martin's producer, manager, and very close friend, Bill McEwen.
We both loved comedy. We were into all the records. We're always investigating how comedy records were created. While he was writing for the first Smothers Brothers show, he decided to leave his agency, which was William Morris, because they were interested in keeping him as a writer. I didn't see any value in him performing. And I said, why don't you let me go over and get you out of the deal? And so I went over to William Morris and negotiated him out of his contract, which is a weird way to accomplish something for an artist, but it was a beginning. We started talking about making a place in comedy through somehow we had no idea how, you know, breaking through. Nightclubs seemed like the first step developing a great act, which he did. And recording became a way of making the act grow. I'd record and record and record, and he would analyze the tapes and change his act accordingly. And as the tapes evolved into a different sequence, the act would change. If it worked, he'd adapt his live performance to what he heard from the edited tape. And even now that happens.
I always had good response in general, because, but you're playing to 100 people and 90 people and 50 people. I never really had a fan, I think, until probably 1974. I mean, the two turning points in my life, one was when I decided in college to write all my own material. In other words, I was in college, I was studying philosophy and art. I thought, hey, these artists are great. They make up everything. So they're original. So I thought I'd be an artist. So I decided to make up everything. The next decision was when I decided to quit opening shows for people, because I knew that there's only one way to make this go further. And you're not thinking then financially, you're just thinking artistically. You know, how can I make this thing go further? And the only way to do that was to make people want to come see you. And the only way to do that was to headline. You know, put your name out there and make people come. Because I don't care who you are, the opening act is always the underdog. And I also figured out that I was losing money opening an opening act. You know, I'd make $200 a night and it cost me $250 to get there. So I went to the boarding house in San Francisco and headlined there for a week. And, you know, we sold out 300 seats on a Saturday. It was the biggest deal of our lives. And then from there, we just kept building.
What's amazing is the way now your audience is so loyal. They know your routines. They come to the concerts dressed in the balloons and in the nose and the rabbit ears.
I think they know specific ideas. But as far as the routines, what I do is I'll change material, but with the same idea. So they, you know, they want to see like the balloons or the Czechoslovakian brother idea or the French guy, but I just can't do what they saw on Saturday night, so I have different lines.
Hey, this guy is good. Guy. Well, I'm rambling round. I'm a rambling guy. I ramble out to the different Times Square in a car, get a hotel. Oh, yes, 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 oh, yes. Oh, no. A rambling guy. Hey, R-A-M-B-L-I-N. Apostrophe, oh, rambling. Okay, everybody! Come on, sing with me! Rambling guy. What's the matter, you people uptight or something? Okay, ladies only, he's a rambling guy, oh Lord. Okay, now the men. Rambling, rambling, rambling. Okay, this half of the room. Okay, now this half, beautiful. There's two-fifths of the room, now there's three-fifths. Okay, two-sevenths, five-sevenths, okay. In Chinese now, Mongol, Mongol, Mongol. Rambling.
Routine that I started in my act about 3 years ago, the wild and crazy guy bit, which we incorporated later into the Czechoslovakian brother routine on Saturday night, the line wild and crazy guy, and that made it very popular.
Where did this wild and crazy guy come from? Who is he?
I don't know. I just, you know, I always thought it was funny. I'd listen to these records when I was, 5 years ago, 10 years, I don't know. Ramblin' Man. You know, I was born a Ramblin' Man, and Joni Mitchell was singing, he's a rambler and a gambler. And so I just decided I was going to be, that's what you always wanted, was Joni Mitchell to fall in love with you. So I decided I'd make myself a Ramblin' Man, you know, and it became a joke. And then and I started doing the accent that I picked up when I took a vacation in France and picked up this, you know, you walk around for 2 weeks going, well, it sure is fun over here in France, isn't it? And I'm wild and crazy. You know, you just start talking and incorporating it into the act.
Do you live any part of your life the way your act is?
Or? I don't know. It's all, it all depends, you know. It depends on who I'm with.
Steve's material a lot of times reflects, and even though he may not admit it, it reflects his true feelings about things. The act to me is like an analysis of his psychological picture. He might not sit down in front of a microphone or a person and say, this is what I think of that subject or this subject, but when you listen to the act, you can, I hear a lot, but I sit there with earphones on and listen to it for hours and hours too. And I hear the cynicism and the attitude and the positive, occasional positive side of it. It's strange, you know. I sit there, as a lot of people do, who are close to the material, and maybe we don't laugh overtly like you would laugh the first time you've heard something, but every night I'm enjoying or responding to his timing or his nuance, his style.